Good morning. May it please the court, Jason Anderson with Carney Badley Spellman on behalf of the appellant, Troy Hansen. I would like to reserve 3 minutes. And Troy asks this court to reverse in part and remand with directions, including for restitution under RAP 12.8. And I want to first address the trial court's finding of waste. This relates to the party's acquisition of C.J. Johnson's bail bond business, which added a Tacoma location to the community business. Now, significantly, the wife, Amber, does not challenge the acquisition of the business, only the funding source for the down payment. The trial court found that Troy wasted community assets by cashing out a retirement account to fund the down payment, and it charged him with 100% of the costs of accessing those funds, as if all of that money would otherwise have been available for distribution. To sustain that result, Amber had to prove the existence of an alternate funding source that would have cost the parties nothing. Not only did she fail to carry that burden, she presented no evidence of any alternate funding source, nor did the court find that one existed. Amber asserts for the first time on appeal that the parties could have borrowed against equity in their real estate holdings. Although she presented no evidence on this, there is no indication that doing so would have been cost-free. At a minimum, the parties would have incurred closing costs and interest, as well as taxes on the income that could have been used for debt service. Also, encumbering a previously unencumbered real property would have exposed it to the possibility of foreclosure in the event of default. The lack of evidence of a cost-free funding source is dispositive on this issue.
Does it have to be cost-free or just cost less than the $120,000 in penalties?
It has to be cost-free because the issue was that the claim was that all of this money, that the costs, would have been available for distribution but for this supposed waste of assets. And the court charged Troy with a penalty of 100% of those costs. So if it was one that cost less, then I suppose that could have been shown there needed to be an offset. But in addition, Amber's own expert witness, Steve Kessler, testified that the use of the IRA was, quote, brilliant. And Amber implies in her brief at page 14 that Mr. Kessler was speaking of the transaction generally, but not the use of the IRA. If you review his testimony at RP 341, it was both the transaction and the funding. Not only that, Amber undisputedly knew that the IRA was being used for this purpose. That's at RP 421. She didn't object, so this case is nothing like Marriage of Stedman, where the husband deliberately failed to pay taxes, unbeknownst to the wife and for no good reason, resulting in penalties to the IRS. Here, the parties simply decided to incur the cost of accessing their own funds, avoiding further debt, for an undisputedly productive purpose, which increased the pool of community assets. The finding of waste is not supported by substantial evidence. It should be vacated. And the entire penalty that was allocated to Troy should be vacated because the pool of community assets was divided 50-50, but Troy's part was this $120,000 approximately was treated as if it were an asset distributed to him.
Part of the findings of the court that related to this transaction were, in addition to the finding that it was wasteful, the court also found that due to Troy's actions in contemplation of divorce, the party's estate has minimal liquid assets. Isn't that also a consideration in terms of whether this is supported?
Sure, and Amber received half of the nearly $10 million community estate, including a cash payment of $600,000 plus $1.2 million in maintenance paid over 5 years, liquid assets. Plus, Amber was opposed to the idea of receiving an additional $1 million in cash in lieu of the property ownership interest in BH Properties, which she was awarded. That's at RP 1255 to 56. There was no prejudice to Amber from this transaction in terms of the assets available for distribution. It actually increased the community estate, and there was no waste. I want to touch briefly now, if I can, on our second issue, which is a major inconsistency between the findings and the decree. The court found that the Kent property, 607 Central Avenue, was Troy's separate property and awarded that property to him, yet it included that property in its valuation of the community business. Amber argues that this error is cured by a Shannon finding by the trial court, but that's irrelevant because this is not a dispute about characterization of assets. No one disputes that the Kent property was Troy's separate property or that the business was community property. The issue is that the The Kent Troy's separate property was included in the pool of community assets that got divided 50-50, thus depriving Troy of half the value of this separate property asset that was awarded to him. This should be undone.
Why is it not within the realm of the rule that all of the party's property is before the court and there's nothing that requires the court to divide the property 50-50?
Well, the court found that a 50-50 division was fair and equitable. And this isn't a situation where the court awarded one party's separate property to the other. The court was clear that this property was being awarded as separate property, yet it included it in the division of community assets. And it's clear that this...
So if the court hadn't made a finding that 50-50 was the court's intention, that you wouldn't be able to make this argument. Are those two necessarily tied together?
No, they're not necessarily tied together, because regardless, there's a clear inconsistency when the court finds that a property is separate property and it's awarding it to one spouse, yet it's included in the pool of community assets by virtue of being included in the value of this business. And it's clear that it had a direct impact on the value of the business, because if you look at Trial Exhibit 1 on the top of page 6, the appraiser notes that this, if there were any change in the value of this Kent property, it would have a dollar-for-dollar effect on the value of the business. I'll move now to the child support issue, which the child support at $4,000 a month and $48,000 a year for two children is more than double the standard calculation for the top of the economic table. Now, the court does have discretion to exceed the economic table on written findings, but the Supreme Court held in McCausland that cursory findings are not sufficient, even if they're supported by the record. And the findings here are practically the definition of cursory. In fact, they're less detailed than the findings that failed to meet the standard in McCausland. Those are quoted in the McCausland Court of Appeals decision at 129 Washington Appellate, page 409. They're also less detailed than the findings in Daubert. The amount of support has to correlate with the children's needs and the family's standard of living. The findings entered here fail to satisfy any of the requirements to specify why the additional support is needed or demonstrate that the court properly exercised its discretion. Child support needs to be remanded, and I'll conclude again by asking this court to reverse and remand with directions to order restitution.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
You have 3 minutes.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Valerie Villison for the respondent, Amber Hansen. We're asking this court to affirm the discretionary decisions made by the trial court that the appellant challenges on appeal. But we do ask that the court reverse the trial court's only legal error, which was requiring the parties to share equally in the cost of the daughter's post-secondary support. I'd like to briefly address our cross-appeal first, unless the court has any immediate questions regarding the appellant's issues. The trial court erred in requiring the parents to pay equally the cost of the daughter's post-secondary support. At the time of trial, the children are ages 7 and 12. As this court held in Daubert, post-secondary must be apportioned in proportion to the net incomes of the parties. In this case, when the oldest daughter...
When there's been a deviation, the court can deviate.
The court can deviate, but the findings in support of the deviation has to support the trial court's decision. And in this case, the trial court entered findings to support child support above the standard calculation, and that included the party's high standard of living, the mother's current reasonable household expenses of $24,000, the father's gross income of over $70,000 a month, and the children's current and historic child-related expenses. All those findings certainly support child support above the standard calculation, but what it doesn't do, it doesn't support requiring the mother to pay more than her proportionate share of post-secondary support, especially in this case, where by the time the oldest daughter reaches college age, the mother's maintenance award terminates, and that's 80% of her income. So currently, with her income, the party's proportionate share of income is 66% for the father and 34% for the mother. Once her maintenance terminates, that percentage dramatically reduces for her. And the trial court's order requiring her to pay half the cost of post-secondary support just isn't supported by its findings, or and it's not supported by anything in the record.
Are you essentially arguing that once the court has made findings in support of a deviation as far as regular child support is concerned, and that benefited Amber in this case, that then any decision with relation to post-secondary support has to also benefit Amber? It has to go the same way? I mean, because there are other facts bearing on this. I mean, when the children are going to college, they're not going to be living at home, so her expenses are going to go down, I would assume.
Well,
also, there's $100,000 sitting there.
Two things. One of the daughters will still be in the household when the oldest daughter goes in. And also the $100,000, that will only go so, I mean, unfortunately these days, that will only go so far for both daughters to go to college. So there still will be an additional amount likely that will be borne by the parents. And in this situation, it wouldn't be equitable, and it's contrary to the legislature that the mother should shoulder more than her proportionate share of that cost.
Okay, maybe you should go back and then address the arguments of Troy on the waste issue and the Kent property.
Yes. With regard to waste, one, there's no need to prove that there was some other available asset to pay for this. The trial court has discretion to consider the squandering of marital assets, you know, negatively productive conduct, and the unnecessary incurring of tax liabilities. And that's exactly what happened here. Again, Amber does not.
How can you say it was unnecessary? If it was a good idea to do and it ended up in more money for both parties, then doesn't your argument have to be, but it should have been financed some other way?
Yes, it should have been financed another way. And there is plenty of evidence that there are other ways he could have done this. I mean, it wasn't taking a $240,000 asset and burning half of it. Because out of the $240,000, it was the only substantive retirement account that the parties had. By cashing it in, he essentially got rid of $120,000. And that's $120,000 that they ended up paying in penalties and taxes, and that was assets that would have been available as part of the property division.
You agree that the alternative would have to be a cost-free alternative?
No, it doesn't have to be a cost-free alternative. I mean, because in this case, it could have been anything but, again, burning $120,000 of community assets.
But unless it was cost-free, then there wouldn't have been $125,000 lost.
Well, I also think this court has to consider what the trial court saw based on the evidence is this wasn't just an action he took because it was the last thing he could do. You know, Steve Kessler said it was a shocking decision, one that ultimately it required a good asset, but it was still a shocking decision to use an asset and take a 50% tax on it. But the trial court
said it was a shocking decision or a brilliant move. I've heard both of those.
He said the acquisition was, I mean, the acquisition of the business, it was a good decision, brilliant decision. But it was shocking that in order to fund that acquisition, he took an asset and, you know, and got only half of it. So for a $242,000 asset, they only got $123,000 that they could use. The rest was gone. And the trial court, one of the things that the trial court considered is that this was done in contemplation of divorce, and that in doing so, it left fewer assets available to Amber. Yes, it's true that, you know, the CJ business was part of the community estate, but the problem with this case from the start was most of the party's $10 million estate was wrapped up in assets that she couldn't get to. It was wrapped up in the business. It was wrapped up in real estate involved in the business. There was nearly $1 million in cash accounts that she couldn't get to because that was part of the business. By taking away that one retirement account, it was just less assets available to give to her.
At the time.
At the time.
Because as counsel says now that the trial is over and everything, she's got a lot of cash apparently.
She got the an equalizing judgment, so she got a cash award
okay,
there.
What about the Kent property now?
The Kent property, it's not really clear what their complaint is. The trial court divided the estate in what it considered a just and equitable way. And the way it did that is, it, you know, even if you take the Kent property out of the value of the business, she got 50.8% of the community property, which is exactly what the trial court was looking to do. The trial court said, and even if any of the characterization is wrong, and as he says, nobody's challenging the trial court's characterization, I would still find this property division, as I've done it 58% to Amber and 49, don't make me do math, 49% to the husband was just inequitable. They brought this to the trial court's attention. This isn't, they said, we think this is a Scrivener's error. We don't think you intended to do this. They brought that up in their motion for clarification. And the trial court didn't make a change because she knew what she was doing, and that's exactly what she wanted to do to make what she considered a just and equitable division of property.
And now McCausland, cursory findings.
These were not cursory findings. The trial court did exactly...
Wealth.
Well, what they said, the high standard...
And money.
High standard, yeah. And those are all things that the court's required to consider in deciding whether to award child support above the standard calculation. It's, the children's needs and additional child support commensurate with the parents' incomes, their resources, and their standard of living. And in this
There's
case,
no need to identify what those needs are.
The trial court pointed out the mother's financial declaration when she said her anticipated reasonable expenses of $24,000, and that came from her financial declaration, which was Exhibit 54. So all of her expenses were already set out, and the trial court found those were reasonable. And based on those, the trial court said the child's needs, which were set out in the financial declaration, and their historic child-related expenses, all supported an award of child support above the standard calculation.
Let me ask you one other question, since time is short. You've asked for an award of attorney's fees on appeal, I think?
Yes.
And I don't believe that there was an award of attorney's fees given at the trial level, except that there was one for intransigence. But other than that, there was not a need-based...
The trial court made... broad findings of both intransigence because of all the contempt and the discovery issues. And I believe there is a finding that it's also based on her need and ability to pay.
I see.
I believe it's cited in my brief.
Wouldn't you agree? In other words, she does have a tremendous amount of cash now.
This is a case where she has a GED. She has ADHD. And the trial court said there's not a likelihood that she's going to be earning any significant amount of income, whereas we have the husband who's already earning about $80,000 gross a month, will probably have the ability and will make the right decisions to earn even more. There is no reason for, why she should continue to have to pay attorney fees from funds that were intended for her to maintain her from here on out. This is a 19-year relationship. The maintenance and the child support is to sustain, her and the children in their household. And her property award was intended for her to maintain, not for her to have to use on attorney fees. In this case, when, I would say that the issues that are raised here, they're all discretionary by the appellant. And there's no reason for this to have been litigated as far as it did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The cross appeal is essentially an acknowledgement that the findings were inadequate on child support. The court had to identify what the needs and expenses were that were supposed to be covered by this additional support. It failed to do so. On the waste, Amber did have to show
on that the cross appeal issues. Was this something that was argued extensively to the trial court? What the percentage should be for post secondary?
Actually. I believe the parties asked for a pro rata division, and the trial court increased it to 50-50.
Deliberate decision.
Pardon?
Deliberate decision.
Yes.
Exercise of discretion by the trial court.
Yes, it was.
So your argument is you're in favor of what the trial court did. You like you didn't ask for the 50-50 is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the trial court exceeded the economic table, and therefore it can deviate from proportionality as to the extraordinary expenses.
So, and was the argument presented by Amber to the trial court that, oh, no, you can't do this because it's supposed to be pro rata even – Or at least it's supposed to go in the same direction as the findings that were made in support of the child support deviation.
I don't believe it was. If it was, it would have been on reconsideration because the parties didn't know the court was going to do this until it did.
Okay.
So On the waste, she did have to show a cost-free alternative because otherwise you can't justify charging Troy with 100% of the costs of using the money that was undisputedly for a productive purpose. And it was her burden to establish the amount of waste, if any, because, again, she didn't oppose the transaction itself. On the Kent property, council references the denial of reconsideration. This is not like the Rockwell case cited in the briefing. In that case, the trial court ruled that the husband could work 7 more years until age 60, even though the husband was actually only 5 years from age 60. This court inferred from the denial of reconsideration that the court exercised its discretion to choose the 7-year period. No similar inference can be made here because the error here was not a mere factual discrepancy. It's a legal inconsistency to award an asset to one spouse as separate property and yet divide it its value 50-50 between the parties. Unless there are other questions, I'll conclude, and the parties should bear their own attorney's fees. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That is the